This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. This is the Middle East Studies podcast on the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Ruben Silverman. With me today is Professor Kevin Jones. Professor Jones is an assistant professor at the University of Georgia, and his new book, The Dangers of Poetry, Culture, Politics, and Revolution in Iraq, was published in 2020 by Stanford University Press. So I'm glad that Professor Jones can join us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ruben.
Yeah, and first off, can I ask you a little bit about yourself, your background? What drew you to this field of Middle Eastern studies, to poetry, and specifically to pre-Baathist Iraq?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Ruben. In terms of what drew me to the Middle East, I'm always a little bit sheepish when I answer the question because I feel like the answer is a little bit trite. But I was a freshman as an undergrad when 9/11 happened. And so the Middle East was in the news. I didn't know anything about the Middle East. I decided to take some courses and really liked what I was learning about and gradually got drawn more into learning about the region, studying Arabic. A few years later, of course, the Iraq War broke out. And I was involved at the time in some of the activism against the war. But that's definitely what sparked my interest in learning more about Iraq. But it was just sort of a snowball process of realizing that I didn't know very much about a particular area of the world and that I wanted to learn more, taking classes and gradually developing my interest in that direction.
Huh. And why did you choose poetry then, particularly to look at?
Yeah, so that was a long roundabout decision. When I started my PhD, I really had no idea I was going to work on poetry. I didn't have any kind of major interest in poetry beforehand. I mean, I always liked poetry, but nothing special as far as I was concerned. I didn't have like a real fascination with poetry. I started out. I knew I wanted to write about Iraq, I was particularly interested in the British Mandate period, partly because I thought it would help me better understand relations between Iraq and the West and understand something more about the context of the American occupation there. So I was looking for a way in. I began a project that was really designed. The dissertation initially was designed as a look at anti-colonial politics in Iraq. And ended up being sort of, or at the beginning, it was conceived as sort of partly about Iraqi politics, partly about cultural forms of anti-colonialism, and then partly social history involving agrarian politics and the like. And then eventually I just concluded that the poetry sections were richer, a bit more innovative. It was more exciting to me. And so gradually over time, the politics thread dropped out a little bit. It was always important to frame the argument, but I felt like I had a lot more to say about the role that poetry was playing in particular forms of social and political activism. And so eventually the project was just sort of reformulated as a story about the role of poetry in these particular forms of anti-colonial politics.
Huh. Well, yeah, man, that makes sense. And it does work very nicely. And so in the book, you focus on particularly neoclassical poetry and the poets who grew up performing, writing neoclassical poetry around Najaf. Can you give us a sense of the literary scene in when your book starts, the last years of the Ottoman Empire? What does it help us understand about the regional importance of in Iraq and how that connects with this type of poetry? Yeah, that might be a good place for us to start, I think.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. The first chapter really kind of lays out what the poetry scenes were like in the late Ottoman period. And my argument is that before, let's say, the first decade of the 20th century, you're really talking about at least three different distinct poetry scenes. There's one in the south centered around Najaf, but they would incorporate some of the surrounding towns like Hilla. There's the scene in Baghdad, and then there's the scene in the north in Mosul. And of course, there would be some interaction and some connection, but there were, because poetry was not, you don't have a big publication industry, you're not publishing Diwans, collections of poetry at the time. There were very few newspapers to sort of disseminate poetry. It was more about individual oral scenes and the individual teachers you learn from, the kinds of physical audiences that might be present in a room when someone is reciting poetry. So it's very much three distinct local scenes. That starts to change in the last decade of the 20th century, particularly as you see some movement of Shi'i poets in particular between Najaf and Baghdad, that really starts to bridge connections between those scenes. So you start to see the emergence of shared affinities between those scenes. And then I think you see further developments with the rise of the premier Nahda periodicals, most of which were based either in Cairo or in Beirut. So we're talking about El Halal, El Muqtataf, El Muqtabas, a number of other literary periodicals that published a lot of poetry. And what started happening is that there's two poets in particular, Maruf Arsefi and Jamil Sidki Azahawi, who began sending their poems off to these premier literary journals, literary and political cultural journals that are being published in Cairo. And they started to be published in those journals, which for the first time was giving Iraqi poets representation in this transnational press outside of Iraqi borders. Now, young Iraqis, especially poetry aficionados, were eagerly reading those journals that showed up into Iraq and began circulating in Baghdad and Najaf. And they were really thrilled and excited to find that there's Iraqi voices in those scenes. And it's really striking to go back and look at the journals, because every time these Iraqi poets appear, especially the Rusefi and Zahawi, they're always framed as these sort of very distinctive Iraqi voices, right? The editors always make a point to play up the fact that they are Iraqis and that there's something unique about their poetry style because of their Iraqi origins. This is different than what we see in Egypt. It's got more of that Bedouin twang, they would say, even though Rusefi and Zahawi have no sort of Bedouin background themselves. But it's those are the sort of descriptions used to describe their unique style of poetry. And in a lot of ways, like the whole idea of an Iraqi poetry scene was defined by editors and readers outside of Iraq who read these poems and said, this is nothing like what we have in Syria or Lebanon or Egypt. It must be this distinct Iraqi style. And then eventually what happens is you get a sort of reflexive competition from some of the young Najafi poets, because both Rusefi and Tahawi were based largely in Baghdad. And the young Najafi poets read this. They saw these guys being defined as the premier Iraqi poets. And they said, hold on, we have our own poetry tradition that we're quite proud of. And so there was this rush in the years after the Ottoman Constitutional Revolution in 1909, 1910, 1911, to try and put together these poetry diwans or collections of verses from the teachers of this younger generation. So in this period, right after the Constitutional Revolution, we're talking about young men in their late teens or early 20s who are trying to publish the work of the men who taught them. There's two in particular, Habubi and Tabatabai, who are sort of held up, lionized, and lauded as the sort of real architects of the Iraqi poetry Nahda. But it's very much a competition, this desire to say that, like, you know, the Nahda, the Arab Renaissance, is not something that begins in Cairo or Beirut and then gradually spreads to Baghdad, which is a little bit behind Cairo. And then from there, it percolates down into the more provincial towns like Najaf. No, among these young Najafi poets, there's this desire to say, actually, the true roots of this literary renaissance, where you see the real sort of innovation and emergence of neoclassical poetry, we trace that to Najaf itself. In the 19th century, we're proud of that tradition, and we want to publicize it to broader audiences.
You know, and maybe it's worth mentioning what is neo about neoclassical poetry at this time? What are they contributing? What is the change that they're involved in at this point?
Yeah, so the neoclassical is the term we give it. It's not used in Arabic, but I think generally speaking, it's seen as an attempt to reassert classical standards and style. So the whole concept in neoclassical tradition is the idea of reviving the classical tradition. There was a general consensus among most readers of poetry that there was a long period of literary and poetic decay and decadence that spanned the majority of the Ottoman period. So everyone basically agreed that the poetry of the 1600s, Arab poetry in the 1600s and 1700s, early 1800s was terrible. Some modern historians and critics have I think, rightly questioned that assumption. But that was an assumption that was basically shared by all these young poets in the 20th century, that something had gone wrong and neoclassical poetry represented the revival of that glorious classical tradition. So it's a deliberate attempt to recreate and reinvigorate the aesthetics of classical Arabic poetry. Now, what's new about it is the content, right? It's basically taking classical aesthetics and style and using it to express quintessentially modern themes, engagements with modern politics, anti-colonial themes, appeals for social and cultural reform. It's sort of desire to make this appeal for modernity that's cloaked in the language and rhetoric of classical aesthetics.
Well, and as you say, so these poets you're looking at the beginning, they're entering the scene right about when World War I starts. And so you point to the period of World War I until the Iraqi revolt in 1920 as marking a real shift, right, from traditional sort of patronage-based modes of poetry to one that's tied into what you just mentioned, radical ideas, mass politics. And you call this rebel poetry, which I like the term. And I'm hoping you could elaborate a bit on the concept and the context in which it's happening.
Yeah, so I mean, to me, rebel poetry is fundamentally connected to the colonial era and to anti-colonial politics. And I think maybe one way of positioning this is that we have to think about the context in which poetry was written and recited before the colonial era. It could be published in newspapers. It could be recited at gatherings. It could be used to praise a particular ruler. But it often had a political message. There's some minor examples here and there. But in my view, before World War I, there was nothing particularly dangerous about poetry. It's not usually used as a vehicle to directly challenge power structures. And that's partly due to the reality of patronage, that poets were often seeking the patronage of a particular ruler, some financial support, a position in government, et cetera. Well, that changes in the colonial era. Because, of course, there's now a dramatic gap between what your audience, the Iraqi nation, wants and what the men in power, the colonial state, want. And so one thing that I found really interesting was looking at the Iraqi newspapers that appear from 1917 onwards under colonial patronage. There's a couple of newspapers that pop up that publish a ton of poetry. Some of it's written by good poets writing under pseudonyms. Some of it's what I think of as very bad poetry. I try not to comment too much on the aesthetics of the poetry, but some of it's really quite bad. But it's being solicited to offer some sort of cultural legitimacy for the British occupation. But one thing that's striking is that none of the poets who are publishing these poems and these newspapers that are popping up are willing to use their own names. They're only publishing under pseudonyms because the act of praising the colonial state or the colonial occupation in verse would be quite detrimental to their reputations. And then later on, especially when we hit 1920, when there's a major national uprising, that is what I see as the real heyday of this phenomenon of rebel poetry. You get this whole series of scenes in mosques around Baghdad, and then later across the country, there's a deliberate attempt to have to bring Sunnis and Shia together in one another's mosques and to have sermons recited, to perform religious ceremonies that are supposed to bridge sectarian divisions, and of course to have poets come and recite verses that will appeal to the people to stand together, to link arms, to resist the colonial power. I always found it really striking looking at these at the records in the British archives about these poetry performances in the mosques in 1920, because the reports are always filtered through the language of Iraqi informants who are there and are now reporting back. Mm-hmm. And so they talk about the sermons and they'll say the preacher gave this message that's sort of inflammatory towards Britain, but it's always a sort of very rough generalization. And then they get to the poetry and they start quoting lines that the poets recited inside the mosque. And it's really striking. It tells you something about the utility of poetry and that the informant remembers the verses because they're striking. They rhyme. You can remember them. And so you can report back verbatim on what happened. There's one report that I always remember because the informant told his British supervisor, I was so moved by this poem that I was almost ready to take up arms against Britain. And in the archives, I think Gertrude Bell had underlined it and written a couple of exclamation points in the margins, right, to note how striking this dynamic was. But the phenomenon of rebel poetry, a lot of it is about putting your name out there in public, publicly asserting your opposition to colonialism, letting the colonial state know where you come, and letting this sort of oppositional dissident public attitude define your poetry. And I think that kind of messaging, that kind of public symbolism really continued to resonate across the Iraqi poetry scene for the next few decades.
And I'm just curious about this period of the revolt, the initial occupation. Gertrude Bell's circling things and writing exclamation points, but do the British appreciate the importance of poetry? I mean, their informants certainly seem to, but are the British taking it into account, really?
To some extent, they were. To some extent, they were limited by linguistic difficulties. Gertrude Bell was always celebrated as the best of the British Arabists at the time. I mean, you know, historically, she's known as having much better Arabic than T. Lawrence of Arabia, for example. But I found a few different cases in her own letters where she's talking about poetry performances, and she says quite bluntly, I didn't understand a word of what was said, but it was all very beautiful. It was a touching scene. Right. Oh. So she doesn't understand poetry. She had an interpreter who I believe was Sudanese, but I might be misremembering that. In any case, he would read the poetry for her and translate it. And again, in a couple of the letters, I found some passages where she basically indicated that he didn't like poetry and thought it was mostly worthless, and so didn't bother to actually translate a lot of what was going on. I think the dynamics of a lot of the British surveillance efforts, I mean, British officials were definitely reading the newspapers that came out every day and publishing reports about who's saying what, how inflammatory are things. But poets figured out pretty quickly that it was easy to skirt or to escape the eyes of the censor. Because the censors, you know, as non-native Arabic speakers, they were generally scanning the headlines and looking for, you know, if you think about, a native English speaker who's got a few years of Arabic under his or her belt and they're reading a newspaper, they're generally looking for key words, right? If you're worried about anti-colonial sentiment, you might be scanning headlines and the first few sentences or verses of a poem for something about Britain or England. So as long as you can avoid those kind of key words that pop out to the censor, the poetry was often glossed over. And what I noticed was that there was often also a real sort of distinction. This is a bit later in the mandate period, when there's the Iraqi officials and the various ministries take on a little bit of a greater role in government. But there was always a striking sort of division of interests between British officials and Iraqi officials in what they're looking for in the press. And what I mean by that is that British officials were always hyper-focused on op-eds, on editorial lines, right? For them, that's the purpose of a newspaper. The sort of meat and bones of a daily newspaper is the editorial line that the newspaper is promoting. That's what's important. What are they saying about the war? What are they saying about Britain? When we get to World War II, they want to know, like, where do they think that Iraq's politics should be with respect to allied access, et cetera. So that was very much their focus. The Iraqi officials, on the other hand, were much less concerned with the editorial lines and much more concerned with poetry. And my thesis is that the Iraqi officials had a much better understanding of the way that newspapers were read in Iraq and the role of poetry, because often these newspapers would be, you know, the literacy rates were fairly low at the time, and newspapers were often read aloud in cafes to large audiences, public audiences. And often the poetry was the real selling point, right? That's what people wanted to hear. What's the poem that's in the newspaper today? And so that's the part of the newspaper that could be really damaging or threatening, right? If a poet's attacking a particular government official or a particular government policy, that's going to resonate among the public to a much greater extent than an editorial would. And so often it's, Iraqi officials pushing for poets to be punished because of what they're publishing in newspapers, whereas the British officials are much more concerned with the editorials themselves.
That's interesting. I mean, and it brings me to the next question I was thinking of asking, which is that during the British mandate, when you have, you know, Faisal in place as king, but the British still present as well, how did poets position themselves in relationship to this Hashemite monarchy, which is, you know, the front man in some senses at least, for the British Empire? How did poets relate to it?
Yeah, that's a good question. The metaphor I use in the chapter that deals with it is the metaphor of the double-edged sword, which comes from a British intelligence report about the performance of one particular poet at a major event where Faisal was present and Faisal was being praised. And that the argument is that the praise of this poet was a double-edged sword. Now, what does that mean? It means that the poet was praising Faisal not so much for things that he had done and things that he had accomplished, but for things that the poet hoped and expected him to accomplish in the future, which meant the realization of full independence, the final liberation of Iraq from British colonial rule. And here the praise is somewhat, it's sort of dangerous game, and that the praise is not really praise. It's partly a threat, right? If you're praising Faisal for, you know, the liberation of Iraq is coming, that's your way of saying in a threatening tone, we expect you to fulfill the sort of lingering desire of this nation for full liberation, and you're doing it in public, which puts him on the spot. I mean, in a lot of these performances, when I read the stories about them, the stories in the police archives, the Iraqi newspapers, the lines of the poetry themselves, it's not hard to imagine the faces of King Faisal and other Iraqi politicians who were there just turning red or turning white, being drained of color as they realize what's going on, but they can't do anything except stand there and listen and endure and sort of smile politely and then, sort of deal with the poet at the end. But yeah, so a lot of that is happening. I mean, sometimes it's less of a threat than others. There's no question that a lot of poets really want to make a living, right? They wanted a post in government. They wanted to be a position in the Ministry of Education as a school teacher. Some of the poets who later became very prominent anti-colonial and sort of political dissidents in the country began seeking employment in the royal palace. So, you know, it's a hit and miss. And sometimes poets would sort of alternate between a stance of political dissent and then a sort of somewhat slavish position of expressing conventional praise if they got the rewards that they were seeking. And then when they're not happy with the reward, they go back into a position of opposition. So in part, it's a sort of game that's based on what the rulers, what the politicians are willing to offer in exchange for praise or to sort of free themselves from this dangerous criticism that could jeopardize their reputation. In part, it's a play for popular legitimacy, popularity, because these stories of the poet embarrassing the king circulate. People love to hear that.
Well, so after 1932, once the British are at least in a formal legal sense gone, even though they've helped create this constitution that allows them to stick around in many ways. From 32 to 58, you have this period of the Iraqi monarchy. And during this period, the politics gets very complicated because you have different nationalist strains, you have pan-Arab nationalism, you have more of an Iraq-focused leftism. And even these different categories are not fixed, right? So the politics and the history become very complicated during this period, and how the poets navigate this complexity also becomes very complicated. But I liked how you talked about it, and I thought that maybe two of the poets that you point to could be good guides for this. You talk about Muhammad Salih Bahar Alum and Muhammad Mahdi al-Jawahiri, and these two poets, you sort of play them off against each other at times. Maybe we can talk a bit about each of them and how they relate to this the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and some of the complexities of it.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. So I would say with Bahar al-Ulum and Jawahari, and I agree, I do see them, if I had to identify sort of real protagonists of the book, it would be those two poets. And I think maybe I see them, they play off one another in some ways, especially in terms of their style. Bahar al-Ulum had a very sort of simple, direct style. He's considered the people's poet. I loved him when I was first starting this project because when I'm first getting into translating poetry, he was very easy to translate, very direct language, simple, short poems that got right to the point. Whereas Jawahari, a beautiful poet, regarded by many as the greatest Arab neoclassical poet of the 20th century, but very difficult from a linguistic standpoint, from his style, very, very much more formal, less direct than Bahar al-Ulum. But politically, they were quite similar. They saw each other as comrades. They were friends. They're close to the same age. They're both from Najaf. They both come from prominent clerical families. They both end up moving to Baghdad and gradually becoming more involved in left-wing and communist politics. Neither one ends up actually formally joining the Communist Party, but they're both two of the more prominent members of the Peace Partisans movement, which is a movement in the 1950s and onwards that's largely seen as a communist front organization, very closely aligned with the Communist Party in general. So how does that factor into this this divide between Arab nationalists and Iraqist or left-wing. Iraq is more focused on Iraqi nationalism. You're right that this is like a sort of, it's often framed as this bipolar conflict, right? You're either in the nationalist camp or you're in the Watani, the Iraqi nationalist camp, right? Pan-Arab nationalism or Iraqi nationalism, one or the other. And I think in some ways it's justifiable that we have that bipolar distinction, because certainly by 1959, that was essentially the stakes of the debate, right? It was a heated political scene after the revolution, and you either belong to the Qaumi, the pan-Arab nationalist camp, or the Watani, the Iraqi nationalist camp, which was associated with the Communist Party. It was an us versus them situation, and you had no choice but to affiliate yourself with one faction or the other. And there's other times in which you had to make similar decisions. There's the first big military coup in the country in 1936 had a similar dynamic when everyone chose sides. You were either for the coup because you thought it would lead to socialist revolution. That tended to be the Iraqi nationalist camp position. Or you opposed the coup. This was the position of the Pan-Arabist camp because it jeopardized Iraq's relationship with or Iraq's support for the Palestinian movement as they saw it. Right. So, I don't want to criticize the idea of this bipolar struggle, but I do think that sort of reading this entire period through the lens of that Qaumi versus Watani divide misses a lot of the complexity of the period. And I think the complexity you can see in two different ways. On the one hand, these two camps are not entirely defined by the issues that give them their name, right? In other words, the Qaumi camp is not entirely motivated by pan-Arab concerns. That over time, in particular, the Qaumi camp adopts a lot of socialist platforms. So that they, in a lot of ways, they're coming much closer to the leftists, to the Iraqi Communist Party than is commonly understood. And on the reverse side, the Watani camp and the Communist Party were much less hostile towards pan-Arab nationalism than people assume sometimes. Really, it's only in 1959 or so that opposition really comes out. For most of this period, they're very much concerned about pan-Arab issues in Palestine and Syria and Algeria, in Egypt and elsewhere. They're enthusiastic about the same causes. And so the related point of complexity is that even though you have this bipolar struggle in 1936 and in 1959, in the intervening two or two and a half decades, what you see is the two camps really converging with one another and adopting some of the positions of their opponents, or the people who were their opponents and will be their opponents in the future. Really, it's in the political scene, this is the sort of days of the National Front politics, where the socialists and the Arab nationalists and the communists are trying to reach a sort of accommodation because they all stand against colonial influence and the sort of neo-colonial monarchy that everyone opposes and is obstructing any sort of real reforms in the country. But in my view, that National Front politics is not a sort of superficial function of high politics. You can really see it playing out across the cultural spectrum, where everyone shares a commitment that, like, yeah, the politics of this country need to be radically reformed. We need to stand with Nasser. We need to stand up for the Palestinians. We need to break our alliance with Britain and with the United States. And in social terms, everyone from both sides agrees that radical reforms are needed, that there needs to be actions taken against feudalism and feudalist-like practices in the countryside. That everyone is critical of capitalism, especially as it's expressed with foreign American and European companies. So yeah, you see both sides really coming together. And I see a lot of that. I think Badr al-Ulum is maybe a prototypical example of that, because on the one hand, he's very much associated with the Communist Party. He's not a communist himself, but he leaves Najaf, he goes to Baghdad, he becomes a labor organizer. He's very close to the workers throughout his life, to peasants. He's a member of the Peace Partisans movement. He praises the Soviet Union over and over again in his poetry. He praises North Korea. So he's very much invested in a sort of cosmopolitan, global, left-wing vision associated with the Communist Party. On the other hand, he's a staunch Arab nationalist. He ends up in the internment camps during World War I because he's seen as being complicit in the Rashid Ali movement, and had recited some poetry on the radio in praise of Rashid Ali and against Britain. Although his position is complex in that he had been, well before the war, was extremely critical of fascist aggression in Libya. He's been critical of Hitler before the war begins, but like the Communist Party in general, he supports the Rashid Ali coup because it's the first step of the sort of bourgeois nationalist revolution that will precede the eventual communist revolution and communist ideology. Mm-hmm. So he has credibility. When he goes into the internment camps, he really builds strong relationships with many of the nationalist poets who were who had a much more problematic relationship to Nazism and more problematic views on World War II in general. But they reach a sort of accommodation. Many of those nationalists had been staunch anti-communists. And when they meet Bartolomé, their positions are tempered a little bit because they see a communist who shares their patriotism and their devotion to the Arab people and to the cause for liberation. He's a guy that I really see for a long period of time straddling that line. He's involved in every form of anti-colonial activism across the period, and it's only on sort of rare occasions in 1937, and then again in 1959, when he lines up strongly behind a particular military regime that alienates the nationalists from supporting him.
And that's kind of why I saw him as a little bit in contrast to Jawahiri, just because Jawahiri is closer to the government, right? I mean, he's not in internment camps, for example. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And part of that is Jawahiri does go to jail though a few times. But even after he goes to jail, he's sometimes back on the side of the government. He's in jail in 1937. But then he's released from jail. He's unlike Bartolomé, he never supports the Rashid Ali movement. In fact, goes to Iran so that he doesn't have to. He isn't coerced into supporting it. They do actually. The government does try and throw him into the internment camp because his poetry was recited on the radio in support of the movement by the government of some of the government officials of the Rashid Ali movement himself. But Jawahiri is able to make his case to the new Ministry of Interior and says, yes, but it wasn't me that was reciting the poem. And the poem that was used was actually not about World War II. It was about World War I. So it's my old anti-British poem that's just being recycled. So I can't be held complicit for that. Which in a way points out to some of the absurdity of the government stance toward anti-colonialism, and that if you expressed opposition to Britain in World War II, then you're seen as a Nazi and complicit in Nazism. Whereas if you can prove that your anti-British sentiment is limited to World War I, because the official position of the government is that was good and fine and a critical element to creating an independent Iraqi state, then you're fine and off the hook. So he ends up not being interned then. And actually does his lifetime ambition for a long time was to win a seat in parliament, because in many ways that like getting a seat in parliament is a sign of national recognition of his skills as a poet, right? It says that your poetry is so good that you're considered a sort of representative of the nation and you deserve to have a seat representing the people in parliament. He does finally get his seat in late 1947. He's elected, but then he ends up resigning after just a few months in office because of this big uprising, the Wafba in 1948. One of the most important events of this uprising is that the Bridge Massacre in January of 48. There's hundreds, thousands probably of Iraqi students and workers crossing a bridge over the Tigris River to link up with one another. The police open fire on the students, killing hundreds of them. The death tolls are disputed, but I think most sources would put it at over 200, over 300 perhaps. And one of those dead is Jawahiri's brother, Jafar. So 2 weeks later, for his memorial service, Muhammad Mahdi al-Jawahiri stands in front of the mosque where the memorial was held and takes up a loudspeaker. There's this great picture floating around that's it's actually of terrible quality. So I had initially wanted it as the cover of my book, but it just didn't work because of the quality problems of the picture. But in the picture, you can see him. He's standing on a stepladder in the middle of the crowd. The crowd is holding up the stepladder. He's got a megaphone to his mouth. There's tens of thousands of people around him listening as he recites this poem. And it's come up again and again, especially if you talk to older Iraqis, you see this in oral histories that come out. Everyone who was around that generation in 1948 can recite that poem word for word, at least the opening lines of it, because it was so powerful as a sort of indictment of the political scene and a call for a sort of revolutionary future. And so from that point on, I think Jawahari is much more committed to this sort of public dynamic of making an anti-government case in public, of pushing buttons wherever possible. And so he does get himself into trouble off and on again in the late 40s and 50s.
Hmm. And in 1958, that's just this decisive moment. That's the revolution. The monarchy is swept away. Colonel Qasim comes to power. And we see a lot of these tensions that we've just been talking about really come to a head. And as you said, the 1959, this period, 1958-59, is particularly intense. And I thought some of these experiences and controversies in the time period were well represented by another poet whom you talk about, Abdul Wahab al-Bayati, particularly. I thought the way you talked about him and his experiences of this revolutionary period was very interesting. So if you could talk about that a little bit too, that'd be great.
Yeah, thanks. So when I think the story that I find most interesting about Bayati, so Bayati was, he was, you know, he's another one of these poets who really, much like Badr al-Ulum, he's sort of in a lot of ways straddles the line between communist and nationalist. He was always a sort of staunch proponent of Nasser and Nasserism, that sort of pan-Arab nationalism, but he's also a member of the Communist Party. At the time of the revolution in July of 1958, Bayati was living in the Soviet Union, and like a lot of Iraqi poets, intellectuals, activists of various stripes who were out of the country in exile due to the political environment, everyone rushes back to Baghdad, to Iraq, to participate in this new revolutionary climate. And when the revolution happens, the pan-Arabists and the communists are equally excited. Right, they all saw the old regime as their enemy. They're all glad to see the monarchy down, and they're ready to finally realize a revolutionary vision. There's both Baathists, the pan-Arab Baath Party, and communists who are members of Qasim's cabinet. Right, so both the nationalist and the Iraqi nationalist, the communist factions, everyone is represented in the new government. Everyone is committed to a new revolutionary vision, and it's fine for a few months. But then tensions really start to intensify in late 58, early 1959. And in my view, there's a particularly important episode in early 1959. Bayati published a poem about the Dr. Zhivago affair in the Soviet Union, about Boris Pasternak. And the poem itself, it's really about Boris Pasternak. It's not a metaphor for Iraqi politics. It's about this communist discussion of Pasternak, who's seen to have betrayed the Soviet Union by writing and publishing a novel that's critical of communism. And so Bayati takes the Soviet side. He's really critical of Pasternak. And he includes a line there that the line is, we will make from your skulls ashtrays for our cigarettes. And when I first read this, so actually when I read the line at first, it was Bayati, who was unnamed, was being attacked by a couple of literary critics who wrote a book denouncing the crimes of communists against Arab literature. And so they have this unnamed poet. And I thought, all right, so this verse sounds familiar. That looks to me like Bayati's style. So I looked it up. I couldn't find it in the collection that I thought it was. But then I found the original version of that collection. And sure enough, the poem was there in the original collection. It was removed from later versions. So this is a poem about Dr. Zhivago. Sure enough, the line is there. And when I read that line, that we will make from your skulls ashtrays for our cigarettes, that it's such an evocative image that I had just happened to be reading around that time a book about communist poetry in the Soviet Union, and I knew that image of the skulls as ashtrays for cigarettes came from a famous poem from Mayakovsky, the great Soviet communist poet. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of pretext, is that Bayati is invoking this great Soviet poet to lend support to the Soviet Union in its struggle against Pasternak and Dr. Zhivago. But then that line gets sort of trumpeted by Bayati's opponents and the opponents of the communists in general, the pan-Arab nationalists, who say, see, what he's really talking about is the Qaumi faction, the pan-Arab nationalists. This is what they want to do to us. They want to make our skulls into ashtrays for their cigarettes. And it becomes this big struggle. Like I said, in later versions, later publications of that Diwan, the poem is removed, which to me speaks to a broader, what I find a really interesting phenomenon. There's all of this communist poetry published in 1959 and 1960, which is deeply engaged in this communist nationalist political struggle. A lot of it is very evocative. Some of it is violent, you know. But what happens is, at least for the prominent poets who are publishing this communist anti-nationalist poetry, in the aftermath, after the collapse of the Qasim regime and the rise of the Ba'athist state, anyone who wants to remain in Iraq or to remain relevant in Iraqi poetry considerations makes an effort to sort of clean their record. So there's this like compilations. There's another famous Iraqi communist poet, Bulanda al-Haidari, who puts out his sort of full compilation later on, his 1959 collection is simply missing because it would be too controversial in that period. Bahar al-Ulum, when he publishes his Diwan, the 1959 stuff is gone because it's too inflammatory in this sort of modern context. So there's this sort of collective attempt to erase or forget what was published in that period because it's too painful, it's too dangerous, it's too politically sensitive after 1963.
Hmm. And I mean, your book essentially comes to an end at around this time period of Qasim's assassination, the entrance into politics of the Ba'ath Party. But you're also making another argument at this point about why poetry starts to fade away as having this political power that you've been talking about in most of the book. And I'm wondering if you could discuss that a little bit, the change from neoclassical poetry towards free verse poetry, which you see as having real political impact.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. I always want to be careful in the way that I phrase this contrast between free verse and neoclassical poetry, because the way I describe the transition from neoclassical to free verse poetry in my book, it would be very easy, and maybe I do sort of make this implicit in my writing, but in a lot of ways, it's a movement that diminishes the political power of poetry. So it would be easy to read this as a negative development. And I don't actually mean that from an aesthetic standpoint. I actually really love the free verse poetry and find it, more pleasing to read in a lot of ways than the neoclassical stuff, which can be very sort of, sometimes pedantic and, you know, it follows this set pattern. And, you know, I enjoy the style of free verse poetry more, but that's partly because of like the nature of how poetry was meant to be consumed. In my view, the reason that neoclassical poetry was so powerful is because it has this set rhymed pattern that lends itself extremely well to public performance. I mean, a lot of these poems you can imagine being chanted in demonstrations, especially the neoclassical verses of someone like Bahar al-Ulum, whose language was very simple and direct. And there's a lot of stories, especially from 1948, of him being carried on the crowds, on the shoulders of workers in these big crowds who are walking through the streets of Baghdad, and everyone is chanting his poems as he extemporizes on the spot with these revolutionary verses. And it's the sort of thing that you just can't do the same way in free verse. Free verse, I mean, it can be, it often did still, I mean, it's still, after the transition to free verse, poetry remains extremely popular and powerful in Iraq, and poetry can have, free verse poetry can have just as powerful of a political images and political messages, but it doesn't have the same sort of resonance in the popular protest. I mean, if you imagine reading free verse poetry, you know, I imagine a situation, maybe you're reading alone out of a book or you're in a cafe and things are a little bit quieter. It's more difficult to imagine people chanting it and it sort of raising the passions of crowds in the same way. It becomes more, my view, my end sort of vision here is that the transition to free verse makes poetry much more a feature of art literature, intellectual history. Whereas my argument is that neoclassical poetry was, I mean, sure, these guys are intellectuals, they are literateurs, they're artists in certain ways, but in terms of their social function, they're occupying a more important role here because of how their message resonates publicly. You can't just say, well, this is just literary history or this is just intellectual history in the same way you might characterize sort of poetry in the United States or in Europe in that period.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I was reading your book, one thing that occurred to me was if one's reading a history of like the South African anti-apartheid movement, there's a big emphasis on the role of music, right? Different movements right. have these different types of culture that help motivate them. And for reading this book, I really did get a sense from it that poetry must be understood as central to a lot of these struggles that are happening in the early half of the 20th century. So I love that about the book. And I wanted to end by asking you, are there any poems or poets that you thought were particularly evocative of some of the themes of your book?
Yeah, thanks. So I guess there's two that come to mind. The first, I'll give you one from Jawahari and one from Bahr al-Ulum. So the poem from Jawahari that I want to mention comes actually from the introduction to my book. It's one of the stories that sort of caught me the most and really drew me to this project. These stories of these ceremonial political occasions. Where the poet is invited to give this speech with the hope that he'll be praising the government. And then he flips the tables, flips the script and turns around and uses the opportunity to denounce the political class. So this poem comes from Jawahari. This is in July 1949. He's at a major event. It's a poem recited in honor of Hashim al-Witri, who is the head of the medical college in Baghdad. And so Jawahari had been more or less in sort of out of public view for a year or so after the death of his brother. And now he steps on stage, he grabs the microphone and he says, "I was informed that you have been inquiring, asking about my presence here and there, wondering how such a dazzling star could stay away from the gilded gatherings of notables. But realization has come and overwhelmed you, like morning removes the dusk from your eyes, for I only cease my sermons when I could not find one who deserved to hear the echo of my complaint." So everyone knows this guy's been silent for a long time and he's about to unleash a tirade. And so he goes on to denounce the British, who he calls the rotten Thamesians, from the Thames River. And he says that they're local collaborators who liberally bestow our wealth on white men while we brown men remain confined to our stables. But then the poem ends with this amazing verse where he says, "They boast that a towering tyrannical wave has blocked the path to every outlet and escape," meaning the government boasts that no one can criticize them anymore because they've shut off all passive dissent. "But they lie, for my verses fill the mouth of time, endlessly traversing from the east to the west, tearing them from their youth and dropping them to their fate, destroying their grand palace of lies, for I am their death, bringing their houses upon them, inciting even doormen and babies to curse their name." And then what follows after that is he rips up the poem that he's reading into shreds and walks out, lets it flutter to the ground, which I always think of like the mic drop moment. But unfortunately for him, the government wanted to arrest him and they couldn't at first because they didn't have the text of the poem. They come to ask him, "Can you tell us the poem?" And he says, "Well, I recited it. I tore up the copy, and actually, I don't remember what I said." But it turns out some of his young admirers who were there had gathered the scraps of paper, pieced them together, get it published in a newspaper in Lebanon. And as soon as that happens, they can use it to charge him. And so he spends a short period of time in prison. The second poem that I will give you just a little bit about comes from Muhammad Saleh Bahr al-Ulum. It's a poem called "Where Is My Right?" He wrote it in 1956. And one of the, I think, really striking things about this poem is that for most Iraqis, this is by far his best known poem. It's never been published anywhere other than, you know, maybe in some books that other people have put together. But he never published it under his own name. For a period of time in Iraqi history, it was a crime. There, people were arrested for having handwritten copies of the poem. It's a bitter denunciation of the state, society, the sort of religious class, all sorts of people who are accused of oppressing the rights of the people. And the poem really came to the scene of social media recently in 2019 because a popular Iraqi singer performed it at a cultural festival in Najaf. And it's a really striking scene because this young man is in Najaf, usually considered a sort of holy city because of its relationship to the Shia shrines. And he's singing this poem by a communist poet that is bitterly denouncing the clerics and other groups. So here's the passage that I'm going to recite from the conclusion of my book. You wolves have trampled the people for thousands of years. So leave me to my religion. For what business is it of yours? Have you received a writ from God to intervene in my affairs? When God's book cries from the mosque, where is my right? These hypocrites shamelessly deceive God in full public view. For what is duping God for those who fill the world with deception? If they could seize all power, they would leave none for God. And God would be next to me crying out, where is my right? Taxes are extracted by force from the very poorest of people who have performed 1,000 tasks and never won their right. The losses fall on them while their sheep are stolen by politicians. But the criminal is the poor man who cries, where is my right? A young girl found nothing but swirling dust to cover herself. So she serviced the whole neighborhood, but did not own an inch. She longed for death so that she could at last own a tomb. But then the gravedigger above her cried, where is my right? What is this and the like except an open field of prostitution, where this land is sold in the most despicable trading markets? If our religion says to hurl 80 stones at the prostitute, but the judge who decrees is the culprit, where is my right? Liberate this nation if you are truly preachers of sincerity, from the chains of ignorance, for freedom will repel the greedy. Throw your weight towards securing the rights of workers. Bless the huts ever crying to the palaces, where is my right?
It's a very powerful poem. And as you say, you can find the man singing it on YouTube also. So after reading your book, I went and looked it up. And again, very nice.
Yeah, it's a great performance. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, these type of poems, the stories you tell about them make the book just absolutely fascinating to read. So I hope people will go out and find the book, read it, experience it for themselves. And may I just conclude by asking you, now that this is out there, published, what are you working on now, or are you taking a break?
So I'm working on, there's a couple of threads from the book that I really wanted to follow up on and moving beyond just a sort of poetry-centered project and looking at some of the broader themes that were hinted at maybe in the book. One of those themes that really spoke to me was the way that anti-communist rhetoric in the late 1950s began to acquire the real feel of a moral narrative, and the way it also mapped onto some of the sectarian language in the country. And so I'm working on a project that really sort of maps the evolution of sectarianism in Iraq, and in many ways is going to make the argument that that what we see is a lot of the anti-Shi'i current that develops in the Ba'ath Party in the 1970s, 1980s, and onwards, in some ways is just an evolution of the older sort of discourse of anti-communist rhetoric, and that itself has longer future. But so anyway, I want to look at the evolution of sectarian language and sectarian practices in the modern state, looking at the influence of the colonial state and colonial policies on sectarian dynamics in the country, and really to foreground, because I think in a lot of ways when people are talking about sectarianism in Iraq, there's this heavy focus put on the 1970s and the 1980s. And so this project would look more at the prehistory of those tensions and how we can see the roots of that conflict developing, even at a time in the 1950s and the 1960s when, for the most part, on the surface, it appeared that sectarianism was not very significant or was no longer relevant. So I want to show how those dynamics begin to develop.
Well, that should be an interesting book. I mean, and hopefully it's as interesting to read as this one was. Well, thank you very much, Professor Jones. This was really nice to talk with you about your book. Appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you so much, Ruben.